He had carried out his mission with success. Sole survivor, he bore with him Dr. Bird's secret. But he could no longer reveal it to anyone. And besides, it was perhaps a secret of no worth. Was it not true that, having emerged from an unhealthy world, he had found true health? The wreck had granted him the supreme gift, exile, and a lady whom no one could now take from him. But the island did not belong to him, and remained distant. And the Daphne did not belong to him. Another claimed possession of her. Perhaps in order to continue experiments no less brutal than those of Dr. Bird. Roberto still did not act, allowing the intruder space to play in order to discover his game. He put the clocks back on the deck, wound them daily, then ran to feed the animals to prevent the other from doing it. Then he tidied every room and everything on deck so that if the other moved, his passage would be noted. During the day, Roberto remained inside, but with the door ajar, so as not to miss a sound from outside or from below. He kept watch at night, drank aqua vitae, again went down to the depths of the Daphne. Determined to discover the hiding place of the intruder, he went back to the woodpile, taking care not to roll again on the logs now scattered over the floor. Beyond the wood, he found a place that on the Amaryllis they called the soda, for storing biscuit. Under a canvas there, carefully wrapped and protected, he found first of all a very large spyglass, more powerful than the one he had in his room. The telescope was in a big basin of light metal, and beside the basin, also carefully wrapped, were instruments of uncertain nature, metallic arms, a circular cloth with rings along its circumference, a kind of helmet, and finally, three rounded containers that, to his smell, seemed full of a thick, stagnant oil. What purpose this collection might serve, Roberto did not ask himself. At that moment, what he sought was a living creature. He examined the soda to see if, below it, yet another space opened. There was one, but it was very cramped, so that he could advance only on all fours. He explored it, holding the lamp low, watching out for scorpions and in fear of setting fire to the ceiling. After a brief crawl, he reached the end, beyond which he could hear the water slapping against the hull. So beyond that blind passage, there could be nothing further. He returned to his room and slept. When Roberto opened his eyes, he heard coming from below the notes of a tune as if it were being played by a metallic instrument, repeating at regular intervals the first phrase of the tune. It was pointless to persist in the illusion that this was a dream. It was a new message from the intruder. Once again, he armed himself. Once again, he sought strength from the keg, then followed the sound. It seemed to originate in the clock room, or rather, the music was coming from its far wall, beyond the painting, the canvas representing yet more clocks. Roberto started to rip away the canvas, and behind it there was a door. He aimed his gun, gave the door a kick, and flung himself forward, intrepid. The object occupying the space was an organ with 20 pipes, from whose holes the notes of the melody issued. The organ was fixed to the wall, and consisted of a wooden structure supported by an armature of little metal columns. On a slightly lower level lay the console of the organ, its keys rising and falling according to the notes emitted by the pipes, as if an invisible hand were running over them. Below the keys, where as a rule the organist works the bellows with his foot, a cylinder had been set, in which teeth were fitted, large spikes, in an order which suggested the way notes are arranged in rising and descending patterns on the lines of a sheet of music. Below the cylinder was a fixed horizontal bar, supporting some little levers, which, as the cylinder turned, successively touched the teeth and operated the keys, as they operated the pipes. But the most stupefying phenomenon was the reason why the cylinder rotated and the pipes received breath. To the side of the organ, a glass siphon was fixed, resembling the cocoon of a silkworm. Inside it, two perforated plates could be discerned, one above the other, dividing it into three separate chambers. the siphon received an influx of water from a pipe entering from an open gun port, pouring in the liquid that, through the action of some hidden pump, was obviously sucked directly from the sea, but in such a way that, entering the cocoon, it was mixed with air. The water entered the lowest part of the cocoon with force, as if it were boiling. Spun in a vortex against the walls, it released the air which was inhaled through the two plates. Through a tube linking the upper part of the cocoon with the base of the organ pipes, the air was transformed into song. The water, which meanwhile had gathered in the lower part, ran off through another tube, and moving the wheel of a little mill, afterward emptied by another pipe, through the gun port. The wheel turned a bar that, connected to the cylinder, transmitted its own movement. To the drunken Roberto, all this seemed natural. So natural that he felt betrayed when the cylinder began to slow down, and the pipes whistled their tune as if it was dying in their throat. Obviously, the hidden pump that controlled the intake and flow of the water could operate only for a certain amount of time after being set in motion, and then its impetus came to an end. Roberto went to his room and, finding writing paper, began to draw. He traced the outline of the ship, relying both on the remembered structure of the Amaryllis and on what he had seen so far of the Daphne. Quarterdeck, main deck, gunroom, cookroom, holds, bowsprit, stern. All the nooks and crannies and the blind passage he'd found. But his drawing showed only top, bottom, and length, not breadth. Seen in its length, we would now say in cross-section, the ship revealed no other possible hiding places, but, Roberto thought, seen in its breadth, other places could be lurking among those already discovered. Roberto, pondering, realized that on this ship too many things were missing. He had found no other weapons. Very well. Assumed that the sailors had taken them away, if they had abandoned the ship of their own volition. But on the Amaryllis, the hold had been crammed also with lumber for repairing masts, the helm, the sides, in the event of damage by the elements. But here he had found only enough firewood to supply the cook stove. Also wanting, along with carpenter's wood, were carpenter's tools, saws, axes, hammers, nails. Were there other storerooms? He drew the design over again and tried to portray the ship not seen from a side, but as if observed from the crow's nest. And he decided that in this beehive he was drawing, there could still be inserted a nook beneath the organ, from which it was possible to descend farther into the blind passage. If in the low ceiling of the blind passage there existed a trap through which to hoist oneself into that same newly conceived space, from there anyone could climb up to the clocks and then have the run of the entire vessel. Now Roberto was sure that the enemy could be only there. He hurried below, slipped into the passage, throwing light on its ceiling, and there was a trap door. He resisted the initial impulse to open it. If the intruder was up there, he would wait for Roberto to stick his head through the opening, then overpower him. The intruder had to be taken by surprise from the direction where he was not expecting an attack. If there was a chamber above, it was adjacent to that of the telescope, and Roberto could enter there. He went up, passing through the biscuit storage room, stepping over the instruments, to find himself at a wall that was not of the same hard wood as the hull. This wall was fairly thin. As before, on entering the place from which the music came, he gave a sturdy kick, and the wood splintered. He was in the dim light of a rat's nest, with a little porthole in the rounded far walls, and there, on a pallet, his knees almost against his chin, his outstretched arm clutching a big pistol, was the other. He was an old man, his pupils dilated, his desiccated face framed by a pepper-and-salt beard, his sparse white hair standing up on his head, his mouth almost toothless, the gums the color of blueberries. He was engulfed in some cloth that once might have been black, but now was greasy, with pale stains. Pointing the pistol, which he gripped in both hands as his arms trembled, he shouted in a weak voice. The first sentence was in German or Dutch, and the second in halting Italian, a sign that he had deduced his interlocutor's nationality by looking at his papers.
"If you move, I'll kill you."
Roberto was so surprised by the apparition that his reaction was slow, and just as well, for he had time to realize that the pistol was not cocked, and the enemy, therefore, was not much versed in the military arts. So he went over amiably, grasped the pistol by the barrel, and tried to slip it from those hands clenched around the butt, while the creature emitted wrathful Germanic cries. With some effort, Roberto finally managed to wrest the weapon from him. The man sank down, and Roberto knelt beside him, supporting the old man's head. "Sir," he said, "I mean you no harm. I am a friend, you understand? Amicus." The man opened and closed his mouth, but could not speak. Roberto feared he was on the point of death. He took the man in his arms, frail as he was, and carried him to his room. He offered him water and made him sip some aqua vitae. The man said,
"Gratias ago, Domine,"
and raised his hand as if to bless Roberto, who at that point, taking a closer look at the man's dress, realized he was a cleric. So Roberto found himself facing the imperious, Teutonic Father Caspar van der Drossel of the Society of Jesus. A professor, astronomer, and student of many other disciplines, posted at the General Curia of the Order. The Daphne, under a Dutch captain, had left the Mediterranean shores many months earlier, circumnavigating Africa with the aim of arriving at the islands of Solomon. On the island, and Father Caspar motioned beyond the beach, beyond the trees, a specula melitensis was to be mounted. The nature of this Maltese mirror was not clear, and Father Caspar, mentioning it, lowered his voice as if referring to a secret so famous that it was on the lips of the entire world. Often following the whims of the trades, the Daphne ended up in storm after storm and would be badly mauled, so they would have to stop at some godforsaken island without trees. There they would patch up the ship, and this explained why there was no supply of carpenter's wood on board. Then they resumed navigating, and finally came to cast anchor in this bay. The captain sent a boat ashore with an advance guard, decided there were no inhabitants, then three operations, all fundamental, were set in motion. First, the collection of water and provisions, which were by then almost exhausted. Second, the capture of animals and uprooting of plants to take home to delight the naturalists of the Society of Jesus. Third, the felling of trees to provide a new supply of logs and planks, material against future misfortunes. There was a final operation, the installation on a height of the island of the Maltese mirror. This proved the most laborious undertaking, particularly because they could not unload directly in the bay. Between the ship and the shore, almost at the surface of the water, lay a coral reef. They discovered that they would have to round the cape to the south of the bay. Beyond it, there was an inlet that allowed them to land. While on the island, the priest had been stung by a mosquito, causing a great fever, mistaken by the captain and the crew now back aboard the ship, as the plague. But the old man had survived the plague in his youth, and learned men know that such could not strike again. But there was no convincing the captain nor crew. Everyone on the ship boarded the longboat laden with weapons and tools. And since it was foreseen that between the priest's death and the time when the ship would be purified, 2 or 3 months might have to pass, they had decided to build huts on land. Everything that could make the Daphne a manufactory was towed to shore, not to mention most of the butts of aqua vitae.
"However, they did not do a good thing," Caspar remarked bitterly, grieved by the punishment that heaven had wreaked on them for having abandoned him like a lost soul.
For no sooner had they arrived, then they promptly went and killed some animals in the woods, then lighted great fires that evening on the beach, and caroused for 3 days and 3 nights. Probably the fires attracted the attention of the savages. Even if the island itself was uninhabited, in that archipelago there lived men black as Africans who must have been good navigators. One morning, Father Caspar saw about 10 canoes arrive from nowhere, beyond the great island to the west, heading for the bay. They were boats hollowed from logs like those of the Indians of the New World, but double. One contained a crew, and the other glided over the water like a sled. Father Caspar first feared that they would make for the Daphne, but they seemed to want to avoid it, and instead turned towards the little inlet where the sailors had gone ashore. He tried shouting to warn the men on the island, but they were in a drunken stupor. In short, the sailors found the savages suddenly upon them, bursting from the trees. The black men attacked the sailors who, unable to defend themselves, were massacred.
A horrible banquet ensued and continued 3 days. Father Caspar, in his illness, followed all of it through his spyglass, impotent. The crew became so much butcher's meat, dismembered, then cooked, and finally chewed with great calm between gulps of a steaming beverage. Then the natives, sated, began pointing at the ship. Probably they did not associate it with the presence of the sailors. Majestic as it was, with masts and sails, incomparably different from their canoes, they had not thought it the work of man. According to Father Caspar, they believed it an animal, and the fact that it had remained neutral while they indulged in their rites strengthened this conviction. But now someone probably suggested that if this animal was meek and its flesh as tasty as the sailors, it was worth seizing, and they headed for the Daphne, at which point the peaceful Jesuit, to keep them at a distance, lit the fuse of a cannon already loaded, turned it towards the island, and fired a ball. With a great roar, the animal ship snorting with wrath, the ball fell amid the natives, overturning 2 of their boats. The portent was eloquent. The savages went back to the island, vanishing into the woods. They emerged a little later with wreaths of flowers and leaves which they cast on the water, making gestures of reverence before they vanished beyond the western island. They had paid what they considered a sufficient tribute to the great irritated animal, and surely they would never be seen again on these shores. They had decided that the area belonged to a peevish and vindictive creature. This was the story of Father Caspar van der Drossel. For at least a week before Roberto's arrival, he had felt ill again, but had already begun to enjoy his convalescence when one night he heard footsteps on the deck. From that moment on, out of fear, he fell ill again, abandoned his room, and took refuge in that cubbyhole, taking with him his medicines and a pistol, not knowing whether or not it was loaded, and from there he emerged only to seek food and water. At first he stole the eggs for nourishment, then he confined himself to consuming the fruit. He became convinced that the intruder, in Father Caspar's account the intruder was naturally Roberto, was a man of learning, curious about the ship and its contents, and he began to wonder if this man might not be, rather than just a castaway, the agent of some heretical country that wanted the secrets of the mirror, the specula melitensis. This is why the good father had taken to behaving in such a childish fashion, intending to drive Roberto to abandon that vessel infested with demons. Then it was Roberto's turn to tell his story. After hearing the incredible story of Dr. Bird, Father Caspar commented, "Such bestialities have I never heard. Why did they do to him that harm? Of the longitude mystery I thought to have heard all. This has no connection with longitudes. I will explain you how good I do my work, and you will see it different." Roberto asked, "Were you hunting for the islands of Solomon, or did you want to solve the mystery of longitudes?" "Why, both, is it not? You find the islands of Solomon, and you have learned where is the 180th meridian. You find the 180th meridian, and you know where are the islands of Solomon."
"But why must those islands lie on that meridian?"
"Ach, mein Gott, oh, the Lord forgive, I take his most holy name in vain. First, after Solomon the temple he had constructed, he made a great fleet, as the Book of Kings says, and this fleet arrives at the island of Ophir, from where they bring him 420 talents of gold, a very big richness. It is significant that the fleet to the ultimate edge of the world had gone, here."
"But why here?"
"Because here is the meridian 180, which is exactly the one that divides the earth in 2, and on the other side is the first meridian. You count 1, 2, 3 for 360 degrees of meridian, and if you are at 180, here it is midnight, and in that first meridian, noon. Understand?"
"I understand. If we are on the 180th meridian, we are at the Solomon Islands, but how do you know we are actually on the 180th meridian?"
"Why, the specula melitensis, nicht wahr? It proves the 180th meridian passes just there," he said, pointing to the island. The next day, Father Caspar, who never lost track of time, informed Roberto it was Sunday. He celebrated Mass in his lodging. That day the priest produced a pair of spectacles, but with smoked lenses, which he had once used to explore profitably the mouth of a volcano. Roberto began to see the world in softer colors, finally very pleasant, and he began gradually to be reconciled to the severity of daylight. Now, in calculating longitude, one must have a point from which to begin to calculate, the prime meridian. It was Father Caspar's point of view that, among the many alternatives presented over the centuries by geographers, historians, and theologians, the best candidate was still the Isla del Hierro, one of the Canary Islands, just off the northwest coast of Africa, 18 degrees west of Greenwich, England. Roberto had already learned from Dr. Bird that in that spot the compass needle makes no deviation, and the meridian line passes through the point very close to the pole where the Iron Mountains are at their highest, surely a sign of stability. If we agree that Father Caspar had set out from that meridian and identified the correct longitude of the Daphne's current position, which he indeed identified as the antipodal meridian, exactly halfway around the world from the prime meridian, we have to admit that while he excelled in carefully tracing the ship's course as navigator, he had failed as a geographer. The Daphne was not at our Solomon Islands, but somewhere west of the New Hebrides, and that was that. However, I must reluctantly tell a story that, as we shall see, has to take place on the 180th meridian. Otherwise it loses all its flavor, while I accept that, on the contrary, it actually takes place God only knows how many degrees away in one direction or the other. I will venture then a hypothesis that I defy anyone to challenge. Father Caspar had erred to such an extent that he found himself unwittingly on our 180th meridian, that is, the one we calculate from our prime meridian, which passes through Greenwich. In which case the Daphne would be at the Fiji Islands, where the natives are, in fact, very dark-skinned. The Daphne would be at the very spot where today our 180th meridian passes, namely at the island of Tavuni. It works, more or less. The outline of Tavuni shows a volcanic chain like the large island Roberto saw to his west. Except that Father Caspar had told Roberto that the fatal meridian passed just in front of the bay of his island. The truth is that with the data Roberto gives us, it is not possible to determine where the Daphne fetched up. Furthermore, all those little islands look the same. But still, I wanted to make a try. One day I would like to retrace Roberto's voyage, searching for signs of him. But my geography is one thing, and his history is another. As it happened, the reasons Father Caspar had set sail bore no resemblance to the larcenous designs of the various navigators of other countries. Everything stemmed from the monumental work that he was writing, a treatise destined to remain more perennial than bronze, on the Great Flood. A true man of the Church, he intended to prove that the Bible had not lied, but also a man of science, he wanted to make the sacred text agree with the results of the research of his own time. "You have in Paris heard," he told Roberto, "of those atheists who of infinite worlds talk, but God has only one world made, and that is enough for his glory. No, think better. If you do not infinite worlds have, and you have not time to make them specially for the flood, and then throw them into the void again, what do you do?" "I honestly do not know." "Now you think. If God could the water take that was yesterday on all the earth, and pour it today, and tomorrow take all that was yesterday, and it is already the double, and pour it day after tomorrow, perhaps comes the day when he all the sphere of ours can fill to cover all the mountains, nicht?"
"I am poor at sums, but I would say, at a certain point, yes."
"Ja! In 40 days he fills the earth with 40 times the water found in the seas. And if you make 40 times the depths of the seas, you surely cover the mountains. The deep is much or far more deep than the mountains high are."
"But where did God find yesterday's water when yesterday was already past?"
"Why, here! Now listen, think, you are on the prime meridian, Now think that here it is noon, and let us say noon on Holy Thursday. What time is it in Jerusalem?
Roberto thought a moment.
Very well. At the prime meridian it is noon. On the 180th meridian it is midnight, for the sun passed already 12 hours before.
Good. Then here is midnight, thus end of Holy Thursday. What happens here immediately after?
The first hour of Good Friday begins. And not on the prime meridian?
No. Over there it will still be the afternoon of that Thursday.
Wunderbar! Therefore here it is already Friday, and there it is still Thursday. No, but when there it has Friday become, here is already Saturday, and the Lord is resurrect here, when there still dead, nicht wahr?
Yes, all right, but I don't understand.
Where here it is midnight and 1 minute, you say that here it is already Friday?
Well, yes, of course.
But think if at the same moment you would not be here on the ship, but on that island, you see, east of the line of the meridian, perhaps you say there it already Friday is?
No, it is still Thursday. It is midnight, less 1 minute.
Good. At the same moment, here is Friday, and there Thursday.
A thought suddenly arrested Roberto.
And that's not all. You make me realize that if at the same instant I were on the line of the meridian, it would be midnight on the dot. But if I looked to the west, I would see the midnight of Friday. And if I looked to the east, I would see the midnight of Thursday. Holy God!
You do not say God, bitte?
Oh, forgive me, Father, but this is something miraculous.
Ach, there is no miracle. If the sun to circle the earth takes 24 hours, the west of the 180th meridian begins a new day, and east we have still the day before. Midnight of Friday here on the ship is midnight of Thursday on the island. You know what to the sailors of Magellan happened when they finished their voyage around the world? They came back and thought it was a day earlier, and instead it was a day later. They believed God had punished them by taking from them a day, because they had not every Friday holy fasting observed. On the contrary, it was very natural. They had traveled from east to west. If from America towards Asia you sail, you lose 1 day. If in the opposite direction you sail, you gain a day. That is why the Daphne follows the route of Asia and U.S. stupid ship the way of America. At this point of the earth, there is a line that on this side is the day after, and on that side the day before. And not only at midnight, but also at 7, at 10, every hour. God then took from this abyss the water of yesterday that you see there, and emptied it on the world of today, and the next day the same, and so on.
Roberto's head was spinning. The only question he could think to ask Father Caspar was what God did to shift all that water from yesterday to today.
The eruption of underwater volcanoes, natürlich. They blow hot winds. And what happens when a pan of milk is heated? The milk swells, rises, overflows the pan, spreads over the stove. But at that time it was not milk, but boiling water. Gross catastrophe.
And how did God take all that water away after the 40 days?
Well, if it did not rain any more, there was sun, and the water evaporated little by little. The Bible says 150 days it took.
You have almost convinced me, Roberto said, who cared less about how that water had been moved than about the fact of being so close to yesterday. But by arriving here, what have you demonstrated that you could not have demonstrated before through the light of reason?
I leave the light of reason to the old theologia. Today science wants proof, so experiences. And the experience is that I am here. Then, before I arrived here, I took many soundings, and I know how deep the sea down here is.
In the days that followed, it became clear that the Maltese mirror on the island could not be reached, because Father Van der Drosso, like Roberto, was unable to swim. The longboat was still over there in the inlet,
but it was as if it did not exist. Now that he had a strong young man at his disposal, Father Caspar could have constructed a raft and made a big oar, but, as he had explained, all the tools and materials were on the island. Without an axe, they could not chop down the masts or the yards. Without hammers, they could not unhinge the doors and nail them together. The company Roberto had kept in Provence and in Paris had been such as to make him skeptical of the assertions of physics and natural philosophy that he heard the old man now make. But as we have seen, Roberto absorbed knowledge to which he was exposed as if he were a sponge, and was not distressed at believing in contradictory truths. If Roberto did begin to have doubts about his host, the latter immediately took him to explore the ship again, and showed him instruments that had previously escaped his notice, allowing him to learn so many and such important things that his trust was won. For example, the Jesuit showed him some fishing rods and nets. The Daphne was anchored in teeming waters, and it was not a good idea to consume the provisions on board when it was possible to have fresh fish. Wearing every day his smoked eyeglasses, Roberto quickly learned to cast the nets and lower the line, and with no great effort, he captured creatures of such size that more than once he risked being pulled overboard by the power of their bite as they snatched the bait. Initiating Roberto into the mysteries of the Solomon Sea, the Jesuit became more precise about the island, which the Daphne, on arriving, had circumnavigated completely. Towards the east, the island had some little beaches, but they were too exposed to the winds. Immediately after the southern promontory, where the crew had landed with the boat, there was a calm bay, but the water there was too shallow to moor the Daphne. At this point, where the ship now lay, was the most suitable. Closer to the island, they would run aground on the coral reef, and farther away they would find themselves in a very strong current that ran through the channel between the two islands. Caspar and the seamen had explored the island, if not entirely, enough to allow them to decide that one hill, chosen as site of the specula, was the best to command with the eye all that land, vast as the city of Rome. In the interior there was a waterfall and splendid vegetation, which included not only coconuts and bananas, but also some trees with star-shaped trunks, the tips of the star as sharp as blades. The island was a paradise of birds, and there were even flying foxes. The crew had sighted pigs in the underbrush, but had not been able to capture them. There were serpents, but none had proved venomous or fierce, while the varieties of lizards were innumerable. As Roberto listened, he became more and more captivated by the distant island. He tried to imagine its shape, its color, the movement of the creatures Father Caspar described, and the corals. What were these corals, which he knew only as jewels that, according to poets, had the color of a beautiful woman's lips? Regarding corals, Father Caspar remained speechless. He merely raised his eyes to heaven with an expression of bliss. He had seen them elsewhere, thanks to an instrument constructed by a fellow Jesuit, and after some rummaging in his chest, he produced the instrument. It was a kind of leather mask with a great glass eyepiece, the upper orifice edged and reinforced. Thanks to a pair of strings, it could be bound at the nape of the neck, making the mask adhere to the face from brow to chin. In a flat-bottom boat, which would not run aground on submerged sandbars, he had been able to lower his face until it was in the water, allowing him to see the bottom, whereas if he had immersed his bare head, there would have been only stinging of the eyes and he would have seen nothing. Caspar thought that the device, which he called an eyeglass, could be worn also by someone who knew how to swim among rocks. Sooner or later, the water did penetrate to the inside, but for a little while, holding your breath, you could continue observing. After which the swimmer would have to emerge, empty the receptacle, and begin again. "If you to swim would learn, you could these things see down there," Caspar said to Roberto, and he continued by saying, "On the island there was the flame dove." Father Caspar explained how hard it was to describe the beauty of this bird. You had to see it before you could talk about it. The day of his arrival, he had glimpsed it through his spyglass. From a distance it was like seeing a fiery sphere of gold, which from the top of the tallest tree shot up towards the sky. "That orange-colored bird," Father Caspar said, "could live only on the island of Solomon, because it was in the song of that great king that a dove was spoken of, rising like the dawn, bright as the sun, It had, as another psalm says, wings covered with silver and feathers with glints of gold. Along with this animal, Caspar had seen another almost its equal, except that its feathers were greenish. They must have been male and female. That they were doves was obvious from their shape and frequently heard cry. Roberto asked how many doves there could be on the island. All Father Caspar had seen was one couple. So on the island there might be just two doves, one orange-colored. A supposition that made Roberto crave that rare beauty, which, if it was now awaiting him, had always been awaiting him since the day before. For that matter, if Roberto chose, Caspar said, he could remain for hours and hours at the spyglass, and see it also from the ship, provided he removed those smoked spectacles. When Roberto replied that his eyes did not allow him to, Caspar made some scornful remarks about that milksop's ailment, and prescribed liquids with which he had treated a colleague. It is not clear whether or not Roberto tried these potions, or if he gradually trained himself to look without the glasses, first at dawn and sunset, and then in broad day, and we cannot say if he was still wearing them when, as we shall see, he tried to learn to swim. But the fact is that from this moment on his eyes are no longer mentioned to justify any sort of flight or absence. But perhaps Roberto wanted to be healed at all costs in order to see the dove, and he would have flung himself on the bulwarks and spent the day peering at the trees, if he had not been distracted by another unresolved question. Father Caspar remarked that all the delights of the island could be found nowhere save on the antipodal meridian. Roberto then asked, "Reverend Father, you told me that the Maltese mirror confirmed that you are on the antipodal meridian, and I believe it. Still, you did not stop and set up the specula on every island you encountered in your voyage, but only on this one. So somehow, before the specula told you, you must already have been sure you would find the longitude you were seeking."
"You think very right. If I here were come without knowing here was here, I could not know I was here. Now I explain you. Since I knew that the specula was the only correct instrument to arrive where to try out the specula, I had to use false methods. And so I did."
Lunar eclipses. To be sure, as Dr. Bird had explained to him on board the Amaryllis, observing them during a voyage resulted in endless misunderstandings. But what about those observed on land? Caspar said, "We have many observers, and in many places of the world, and well disposed to collaborate in the major glory of God, and not exchange insults or spitefulness or scorn." The "we" he referred to, of course, were the members of the Society of Jesus, and these Jesuits, after collecting and collating the observations of their missionary brethren, established a universal clock. It was, in effect, a kind of map of more than half the globe, on which were marked all the headquarters of the Society, from Rome to the borders of the known world, and for each place the local time was marked. Thus, Father Caspar explained, he had not had to bear in mind the hour at the beginning of the voyage, but only at the last outpost of the Christian world, whose longitude was beyond debate. Then the margins for error were greatly reduced. Fortunately, he had brethren just about everywhere, and so from one port to the next, they kept watch over their longitude. "Did you not just tell me," Roberto asked, "that the specula gave you the utmost assurance of being on the 180th meridian off the island of Solomon?" "Yes," the Jesuit replied, "he was certain." He had set in competition the various imperfect methods found by others, and the accord of all these weak methods supplied a very strong certitude. But an important discovery like this had to be confirmed by further proof, so that even the skeptics would surrender to the evidence. Now, of all the methods of taking longitude, two seemed sure to him. One, good for terra firma, was the treasure of all methods, namely the specula melitensis. The other, appropriate for observation at sea, was the instrumentum which lay below, but had not yet been set up, because he first had to obtain through the specula the certitude of their position, then see if the instrumentum confirmed it, which was the most reliable way to proceed. Father Caspar would have carried out this experiment long before if what had happened had not happened. But the moment now had come, and it would be on that very night. The sky and the ephemerides, The tables in an astrological almanac said that now was the right occasion. So then Father Caspar engaged Roberto in the preparation of an experiment that was to be performed on an evening like the one now ahead of them, astronomically opportune, with clear sky and with the sea in slight motion. First of all, they had to recover, among the clocks so maltreated over the past few days, one still in proper working order. Caspar told Roberto to arrange the devices, together with writing materials, on the quarterdeck, which was the highest observation point on the Daphne. And there they would set up the instrumentum. From the biscuit storage area, the soda, they had carried up the instruments Roberto had glimpsed while he was still pursuing the intruder. The two assembled the materials, and in the end they had a kind of great basin in the form of half a spherical orb with a diameter of about 2 meters. It was necessary to tar it so it would retain the malodorous oil with which Roberto filled it, emptying keg after keg, complaining of the stench. He asked, "What is the use of this?"
"On this little sea of oil, we try an even more little vessel to put," Caspar said, and made Roberto help him place in the great canvas basin a metallic pan. This pan was almost flat, with a diameter only slightly less than that of its container. "You never heard say the sea smooth like oil? But on oil the pan floats like on a calm sea. Now we take the pan, where we must in it a whole machine put."
The bottom of the metal pan had some little springs on the outside, so that it would remain separated by at least one finger from the bottom of the container. Having set up the basin on the deck, Father Caspar sat on the seat and explained to Roberto how to place on his back and fasten to his waist a harness of straps and bandoliers of canvas and leather, to which also a helmet with a visor should be tied. The visor had a hole for one eye, while at the level of the nose a rod protruded, surmounted by a small hoop. Through the hoop was inserted the spyglass, from which a little staff hung, ending in a hook. The spyglass could be moved freely until a given star was identified, but once the star was in the center of the lens, the rigid staff was fixed to the bandoliers, and after that a steady view was assured, fixed against any possible movements. And when the pan was set afloat on the becalmed oil, even the most elusive celestial bodies could be studied, and no sea tumult could cause the eye to be deflected from the chosen star.
"This your Signor Galileo described, and I have made. Now, we put the empty pan in the oil, then I climb on."
"I cannot believe that will be easy." Though with some effort, the pan with a chair on it was hoisted up and set afloat on the oil. Then Father Caspar, in helmet and harness, and the spyglass mounted on the visor, tried to climb onto the scaffolding while Roberto held him, one hand clutching his hand and the other pushing his bottom. The attempt was repeated several times, but with no success. When Father Caspar had begun to despair of ever occupying that seat, Roberto observed that perhaps it was necessary first to empty the container of oil, then install the pan, then have the priest climb onto it, and finally pour in the oil again, which, as its level rose, would raise also the pan and, with it, the observer, all floating together. So it was done, amid praise from the master lavished on his acute pupil, as midnight was approaching. Not that the apparatus gave a great impression of stability, but if Father Caspar took care not to move unduly, they could hope. At a certain moment, Father Caspar triumphed.
"I see them!"
The cry caused him to move his nose, and the glass, rather heavy, began to slip out of the circle. He moved his arm to arrest it. The movement of the arm jerked his shoulder, and the pan was on the point of capsizing. Roberto abandoned the clocks and the paper he was to take notes on, and supported Caspar. He re-established the equilibrium of the whole, and bade the astronomer remain motionless, allowing only his eyepiece to make very prudent shifts, and above all without expressing emotions. The next announcement was made in a whisper.
"I see them again. Oh, wunderbar! 3 little stars east of Jupiter, 1 alone west. Wait. Yes, at 0:30 from Jupiter. Right. Now it is about to touch Jupiter. Soon it will disappear. careful and write exactly the time it disappears.
Roberto, who had left his place to assist his master, again picked up the tablet on which he was to mark the times, but sitting, he had the clocks behind him. He turned abruptly, knocking over a pendulum. Roberto tried to seize it, but he failed. Father Caspar was already shouting orders to note the time. Roberto turned towards the clock, and in moving, he struck the inkwell with his pen. Not thinking, he set the well upright to save some of the liquid, but he knocked over the clock. Father Caspar moved the spyglass away from the visor, peered sideways, saw the pendulum in pieces, the clock overturned, Roberto's hand stained with ink. Beside himself, he exploded with a
Himmelpottblitzherrgottskrament
that shook his whole body. In that unfortunate movement, he caused the pan to tilt too far, and he slid into the oil of the basin, the spyglass slipping from his hand. Then, as the ship pitched, the glass rolled across the quarterdeck, bounced down the ladder, and struck the main deck before it was flung against the breech of a cannon. The man, flailing in that rancidity, shouted to save the spyglass. Roberto rushed down the ladder and found it dented, with both lenses broken. When Roberto finally removed Father Caspar from the oil, the Jesuit, who looked like a piglet ready for the oven, simply said with heroic stubbornness that all was not lost. There was another telescope, equally powerful, mounted on the Maltese mirror. They had only to go and fetch it from the island. How? Roberto asked. I told you, I cannot swim.
Learn.
His first reaction, with his shipwreck still impressed on his mind, was to declare that nothing on earth could induce him to resume contact with the water. Father Caspar pointed out that during that same wreck, it was the water that had supported him, a sign, therefore, that it was an affectionate and not a hostile element. It was a question, therefore, of acquiring familiarity with the element, whereupon everything would take its course. He proposed that Roberto lower himself along the rope ladder hanging from the prow, known also as a Jacob's ladder. But for his own serenity, he should remain tied to a rope, long and sturdy, bound to the bulwarks. Then, if he became afraid of drowning, he had only to pull the rope. Roberto gingerly made his way down the ladder, but, looking down and then up, missed a rung, released his grip, and Roberto finished underwater, unable to make use of the rope, now too slack, to return to the surface as planned. He then behaved like all who are threatened with drowning. He made uncoordinated movements and swallowed even more water until Father Caspar tightened the rope properly, pulling him back to the ladder. Roberto climbed up, vowing he would never go down there again. Caspar consoled him on deck.
Tomorrow you try again. Salt water is like a medicine. Do not think it was gross harm.
Roberto's interest in the Maltese mirror was the thought that this oracle could tell him where the lady was, and what she was doing at that moment, proof that a lover, even one distracted by useful corporal exercises, seeks always and only news of his beautiful suffering and his dear grief. Further, whatever his swimming master may have said to him, he dreamed of an island that did not loom before him in the present, where he also was, but instead by divine decree rested in the unreality, or the non-being, of the day before. What he thought of as he challenged the waves was the hope of reaching an island that had been yesterday, and of which the symbol seemed to him the orange dove, beyond any capture, as if it had fled into the past. Roberto was still driven by obscure concepts. He sensed he wanted something that was not Father Caspar's goal, but he was not yet sure what it was. And his uncertainty must be understood because he was the first man in human history to be offered the possibility of swimming 24 hours into the past. In any case, he was convinced that he really had to learn to swim. Hence, we find him trying again the next day. Father Caspar explained that Roberto should let go of the ladder and move his hands freely, as if following the rhythm of a band of musicians, and imparted a lazy motion to his legs. The sea would then support him.
The Jesuit induced him to try first with the rope taut. Then he slackened the rope without saying anything. These attempts lasted a good half hour, and Roberto realized that he could keep himself afloat. But it was not easy to find the proper position. Roberto risked strangling himself with the rope, belching and sneezing. However, at a certain point, he found his equilibrium, and for the first time, Roberto felt the sea as a friend. The next day, Roberto resumed his swimming experiments. Father Caspar tried to persuade him to try and move in the water, and he suggested slow movements of the hands and the legs, but Roberto preferred to lie idle, floating. Towards evening, it became the Jesuit's conclusion that the young man had no aptitude for swimming, so Father Van der Drossel had to find some different means that would allow them to reach the island. More than a week had gone by since their first meeting, when the Jesuit addressed Roberto with an air of decision.
"I cannot wait until you have learned to swim."
He said the weather and the wild animals were ruining the specula, which required daily care. Only one solution remained. He would go to the island himself. When asked how he would do this, Caspar said he would try his fortune with the aquatic bell.
"So I go to the island now with my aquatic bell, walking, as you see me now walk."
He headed for the soda, which was an apparently inexhaustible store. Besides the astronomical apparatus, there was yet more to be found. Roberto was obliged to carry up on deck other bars and semicircles of metal, and a voluminous package wrapped in a skin, which still smelled of its original, horned owner. Working for the whole morning, they assembled a cage shaped like the trunk of a cone, slightly taller than a man, in which there were three circles, the highest being of the smallest diameter, the central and the lowest ones progressively broader. All three of them were held parallel by four inclined bars. To the middle circle was attached a canvas harness into which a man could fit. A number of straps fastened around the shoulders and the chest held his groin steady to prevent his sliding down. The same straps secured his shoulder blades and neck to prevent his head from striking the upper circle. Father Caspar unwrapped the folded skin, which fitted as a glove over that metallic apparatus. And the finished object was a kind of bell. On it, between the top and the middle circles, there was a little glass window. To the roof of the apparatus, a sturdy ring had been attached. At this point, the bell was shifted towards the windlass and hooked to an arm that, through a clever system of pulleys, allowed it to be raised, lowered, lifted over the rail, hoisted aboard, or unloaded like cargo. This bell now awaited only a passenger, who would step inside, fasten the straps, then dangle in the air like a clapper. Once he was well fastened, the inhabitant of the bell could walk, and the straps kept the head at the level of the window, while the lower edge came to his calf. The triumphant Father Caspar explained that when you have a bell full of air lowered into the water does not enter. No matter how deep the sea was, a man could walk without any water entering, at least until the passenger, with his breathing, had consumed all the air. With a bell of that size, the passenger could count on at least 30 minutes' respiration, Father Caspar calculated. The shore seemed very far away, if it were to be reached by swimming, but walking, it would be a stroll, because almost at the halfway point between ship and shore lay the coral barrier, certain stretches at the water's surface. But how could anyone walk on a seabed, which must bristle with dangers, Roberto asked. And how could he climb up the barrier's sharp corals? And further, how would the bell descend without being thrust up, for the same reasons that a diver returns to the surface? With the look of someone who has thought of everything, Father Caspar went and fetched from the inexhaustible soda a pair of boots with iron soles, about 5 fingers thick, fastening at the knee. The iron would serve as ballast, and would also protect the feet of the explorer. In the face of the old man's stubbornness, Roberto tried to postpone the moment of his destruction.
"But if the bell is lowered with the windlass, how do we unhook the cable?"
Caspar answered that once he was on the bottom, Roberto would know, because the rope would slacken. At that point, he was to cut it. Roberto now understood that Father Caspar van der Drossel believed in his bell as he believed in his specula, and he believed he had to use the bell to reach the specula, and he believed that everything he was doing was for the greater glory of God. And as faith can move mountains, it can surely overcome waters. So there was nothing to be done but set the bell back on deck and prepare it for immersion, an operation that kept them busy till evening. To treat the hide in such a way that it was both impermeable to water and airtight, they had to prepare a paste over a slow fire, mixing 3 pounds of wax, 1 of Venetian turpentine, and 4 ounces of another varnish used by carpenters. Then the hide had to absorb that substance, so it was left to sit until the next day. Finally, with another paste made of pitch and wax, they had to cork the edges of the window, where the glass had already been fixed with mastic, then tarred. Father Caspar spent the night in prayer. At dawn, they examined the bell, the straps, the hooks. The Jesuit waited for the right moment, when the sun was high enough to illuminate the sea before him, casting all shadows behind his back. Then the two men embraced. Then the bell had to be raised, with Father Caspar fastened inside it, testing the device to guarantee that he was able to move comfortably. Finally, Father Caspar seemed satisfied with his rehearsal, and, in a voice that sounded as if it came from his boots, he said he was ready to set out. He moved to the windlass. Roberto hooked him up and began turning it, making sure, when the bell was raised, that the feet swayed freely, and the old man could not slip down or up. Father Caspar clanked and re-echoed that all was well, but they should hurry.
"These buskins are pulling my legs and are about to tear them from my belly. Hurry! Put me in the water!"
Roberto shouted a few words of encouragement and slowly lowered the vehicle with its human engine. No easy matter, because he had to perform by himself the task of many sailors. That descent thus seemed eternal to him, as if the sea sank gradually as he multiplied his efforts. But finally he heard a noise from the water, realized the strain was diminishing, and after a few moments he felt the windlass was now spinning idly. The bell had touched bottom. He severed the rope, then rushed to the bulwark to look down, and saw nothing. Of Father Caspar and the bell, there was not a sign. "What a brain, that Jesuit," Roberto said to himself with wonder. "He has done it. Imagine, down in that water, there is a Jesuit walking, and no one would guess. The valleys of all the oceans could be populated with Jesuits, and no one would know." Then he shifted to more practical thoughts. That Father Caspar was down below was invisibly evident, but that he would come up again was not yet sure. It seemed to Roberto that the water was stirring. The day had been chosen precisely because it was calm, but as they were carrying out the final preparations, a wind sprang up which out here merely ruffled the surface a little, but at the shore it created a play of waves that at the submerged reefs could jeopardize Caspar's arrival. Towards the north, where an almost perpendicular wall rose, Roberto could glimpse gusts of spume that slapped the rock and scattered in the air. It was surely the effect of waves hitting a series of invisible rock formations. The beach, however, was calmer. The swell was only at the halfway point, and for Roberto that was a good sign. It indicated the place where the reef protruded from the water and marked the border beyond which Father Caspar would no longer be in peril. Where was the old man now? How much time had elapsed? Roberto had lost all sense of the passing moments, and now he reproached himself for not having brought at least an hourglass up on deck. Perhaps more than a half an hour had now passed. Too long. Another thought. How do I know that the air in the bell has really sufficed for all this time? In the final analysis, dear old Caspar had proved to be a raving eccentric, and perhaps that whole story of the waters of the flood and the meridian and the island of Solomon was a pack of tall tales. And besides, even if he was right as far as the island was concerned, he could have been wrong in his calculation of the quantity of air a man needs. Roberto wrung his hands and cursed his haste. It was self-evident. Here he was, believing hours had passed, and instead only a few pulse beats had gone by. He told himself he had no reason to fear. The brave old man had many more reasons to do so. Perhaps Roberto should support Caspar's progress with prayer, or at least with fond hope and good cheer. He realized that he had grown to love the man who had been the intruder, and he was already weeping at the mere thought that harm might have befallen him. "Now, old man," he murmured, "return, come back to life, be reborn by God, and we will kill the fattest hen. Surely you will not abandon your specula melitensis to its fate." And suddenly he was aware that he could no longer make out the rocks near the shore, a sign that the water had begun to rise, and the sun, which earlier he had seen without having to raise his head, was now truly over him. So, from the moment of the bell's disappearance, not minutes, but hours had passed. Then Roberto had a dazzling thought. The island Roberto saw before him was not the island of today, but that of yesterday. Beyond that meridian, it was the day before. Could he expect to see now on that beach, where it was yesterday, a person who had descended into the water today? Surely not. The old man had immersed himself in the early morning of this